title setting board pursuant to Article 40 of Title 1, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is May 29th, 2008. The time is 1:35 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and representing Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. The other two members of the title board will vary somewhat today. These are all motions for rehearing, this being the today and tomorrow being the last meetings of the title board to consider measures for the 2008 general election ballot. And since they're all motions for rehearing, they will be heard by the title board members who heard the initial hearing on May 21st. And so that will vary somewhat. The two representatives from the Office of Legislative Legal Services are Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is sitting to my immediate left. Also, Sharon Eubanks is the other designee and will be sitting as the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services for those measures for which she heard the measures the first time. For the Attorney General's Office, the two designees of the Attorney General are Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, and Jeff Blue, Deputy Attorney General. These are all motions for rehearing. We do have somewhat of a lengthy agenda. Want to move through things somewhat expeditiously. And anybody who wishes to testify is welcome to incorporate your remarks from the previous meeting if you wish. Anybody who wishes to testify should sign up on the sign-up sheets, which are on the table by the door. There are three members of the title board, so a decision is reached by two of the three members. The ordinarily, after motions for rehearing are decided, the Secretary of State's office will attempt to provide certified results as soon as possible for anybody who wishes to proceed with an appeal to the State Supreme Court. And we will certainly do our best, but because we have a pretty full agenda this afternoon, and then we also have additional items that we're considering tomorrow morning, it may be difficult for the Secretary of State's office to complete the certified results as quickly as we'd like, but we will certainly try to have everything done by the end of the day tomorrow, if possible. With that, let me turn then to the first agenda item, and I think I'd like to take the first two agenda items together unless there's objection. This is 2007-2008 number 125 and number 126. They're nearly identical versions of the same proposal. I think we've got same proponents, same representatives, almost perhaps identical motions for rehearing that have been filed on these. So, if there's no objection, we'll consider them together so that people don't have to repeat their testimony when we get to the second one. For these two items, I'll just remind everybody the Attorney General did recuse their office from consideration at the last meeting. So for these two items, the title board will just consist of myself and Dan Carton. There were two motions for rehearing. One's submitted on behalf of proponents by Blaine Myrie. Another one submitted by Douglas Bruce. Representative Bruce sent a couple of emails today. I think they're both today, and I think copies of these emails are on the table by the door. He indicated that he would not be present in person. One of his emails elaborates additional grounds for objecting to the titles that were set for number 125 and 126. He also submitted an email that relates to his objections to number 103, which we're not on right now, but I'll just mention that as a matter of record. And I think before I probably want to turn to Mr. Murray to talk about his motion for rehearing and perhaps to respond to Representative Bruce's motion. But there are some comments that I thought might be helpful about Representative Bruce's motion that I could bring up. As I recall, on his motion for a rehearing for number 125 and 126, as well as some others, one of the concerns that he raised was the use or non-use of all capitals in setting the titles. And I just wanted to confirm that was that part of 125 and 126? It was not. Okay, then I'll reserve that. I wanted to provide some information on the others where he did raise those issues. Well, then with that, let me turn to Mr. Murray, if I could. And Mr. Murray, I'd like to hear, really, maybe if you'd give us an overview of your motion for rehearing, which you did set out in detail, which we very much appreciate, as well as your response to Representative Bruce's motion for rehearing.
Sure. Doing it in reverse order and responding to Representative Bruce's motion for rehearing, he challenges the single subject requirement. I don't see anything new in what he's said to indicate anything other than the single subject, as the board concluded at last week's meeting, single subject of public education funding, which the board concluded, and I think that was a proper decision, as I indicated in the first paragraph of my motion. So unless there's questions or concerns about that, rest on the record from last week and incorporate my remarks from them, respond to Representative challenge.
Can I, excuse me for interrupting,
sure.
I just want to, I had not, since I had just received a copy of Representative Bruce's email of today at 1:07 p.m. where he enumerated five objections to the titles for 125 and 126, and you've had a chance to look at those, and you're indicating that you feel those are items that were brought up last time.
Well, the number four is certainly, because, and that's the one related to the single subject. Number five, I don't recall whether he brought that up or not. Number one, I don't recall. Again, I don't recall whether he said add two Colorado taxpayers afterwards. The two-thirds voting requirement was discussed in item three. And again, I can't recall on item number two.
Okay.
I just don't have a recollection. I do have the transcript, but it's probably quicker just to address those.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. If you'd then like to proceed with your motion for rehearing.
Sure. Our motion for rehearing doesn't challenge the single subject or the jurisdictional issue. We think the court correctly agreed that a single subject was meant to set the title, but we had concerns about the language. I think these were expressed at the last hearing, having to do with really the first substantive phrase of the measure, which is the ballot title. Requiring that any revenue that the state would otherwise be required to refund pursuant to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending, paren, taxpayers' bill of rights, paren, be transferred instead to the state education fund. Now, the concern which we expressed was the inclusion of the language taxpayers' bill of rights is that it might be misleading and confusing to the voters, might cause them to think it has to do with income tax refund, and more importantly, which we mentioned briefly, it's a buzzword or a catchphrase. Obviously, the issue of taxes is something that to the voters is a critical issue. No one wants their taxes raised necessarily. And there are some people who never want their taxes raised. The Taxpayer's Bill of Rights is a controversial issue and has been. It obviously is part of the Constitution. But it has been the practice of this board not to refer to either TABOR, the acronym, or the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights in its prior settings. In fact, it, I don't want to say studiously avoids it, but in previous years has not used that phrase in any of its settings that I'm aware of. If you look, and I think I mentioned some of these in my motion, just to make them briefly on the record, Amendment 23, for example, did not had language that said exempting certain it exempted certain revenues from Tabor spending limitation on fiscal year spending, and the ballot title said exempting those revenues from the constitutional limit on fiscal year spending. Amendment 21 in the 2000 election similarly would have created a new section of Tabor to implement a $25 tax cut. Still, the ballot title did not refer to the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights or to Tabor. Amendment 26, which we also referenced in our motion. Amendment 33, having to do with exempting video lottery terminal proceeds from Tabor restrictions. That ballot title language simply said exempting net proceeds and license fees from video lottery terminals from all restrictions on spending, revenue, and appropriations. And there's other examples, and certainly there are measures that did not make the ballot where references were made to constitutional limits on revenue or spending. To my knowledge, there has never been a reference to Tabor or the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights included in a ballot title. And I think the reason is that that really is a catchphrase. And as the Supreme Court has defined a catchphrase is consists of words which could form the basis of a slogan for use by those who expect to carry out a campaign for or against an initiated constitutional amendment. And I think it's probably no secret that Representative Bruce wants to include the language Taxpayers' Bill of Rights in the initiative so that it becomes a slogan for an anti-campaign. I think that there's no benefit to the voters to having this included. I think it will cause confusion, particularly for voters, to, you know, newer voters, younger voters who are not familiar with what the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights is. They may confuse it with a Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution or other rights in the Colorado Constitution. Therefore, I think that language should simply be stricken, and as we suggested in our motion, I think the preferred language is one that simplifies the whole thing to the following phrase, requiring that any revenue in excess of the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending be transferred to the state education fund. That statement, number one, is short. Number two is completely fair and accurate. And number three won't lend itself to any problems of catchphrases or misleading the voters or suggesting something the measure does that it does that it doesn't. And I think that is the goal of the title board. So I think that is what should be included in the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights provision should be stricken, as well as the term refund for the reasons I discussed in the previous motion. I'm sorry, the previous hearing, that the word refund, when coupled with the term taxpayer, may mislead the voters to thinking that they are somehow having an impact on their income tax refunds, which clearly this measure does not do.
Shall we pause then at that point and see if there's questions and discussion?
Let's do that.
You know, there's several good issues here that you've raised. I mean, I am troubled by the phrase taxpayers' bill of rights. I think there's, you know, arguments for and against that, and I have some of the same concerns that you've expressed about that phrase, and I recognize that just because Tabor has that phrase in it doesn't mean that it's not a catchphrase. At the same time, I think the board has struggled with how to refer to Article 10, Section 20, knowing that a citation doesn't mean much to voters. I mean, there's never been really a good answer to that. It may be that this one is a little different than most measures where we've been faced by the issue, in that this has a more direct impact than most, in that it affects the Tabor refunds. It eliminates the Tabor refunds, basically, to taxpayers. And so on the other hand, I guess I'm thinking that maybe there needs to be something more informative in these titles than saying, you know, just the constitutional limits on state fiscal year spending or something, which is fairly obscure. And I guess I'm leading up to just simply asking you is about the possibility of, instead of in parentheses saying taxpayers' bill of rights, what about in parentheses saying, quote, Tabor, unquote. Put it in quotation marks. A lot of people may not know what that is. But for those who do, I mean, I think one thing that's different historically is that maybe increasingly that has become a term that a lot of people recognize when they talk about things like Tabor refunds and so forth. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I don't think that necessarily solves the problem, because the term Tabor, though it may be more well known than it's, words it stands for, it still is an issue that is controversial and open to kind of drawing out the emotion that the Supreme Court says is the problem with catchphrases. So I would still view Tabor as a catchphrase. And yes, I think it may be a difficult quandary for the board. I think the board should stick with its prior practice of not including it. But, you know, as an alternative, I think the original staff draft just made the reference to the constitutional provision. Now, I understand that there's some difficulty with that as well, but it doesn't have any of the catchphrase problems. It's an accurate statement of the law. It's an accurate reference to the provision that is being affected. And it states it neutrally without having sort of the buzzword taxpayer or the buzz acronym Tabor. So I don't think the taxpayer's bill of rights or Tabor is I don't want to say sufficient. I don't think it's appropriate, because I think it does rise to the level of a catchphrase, as the Supreme Court has defined that in various cases. You know, the constitutional limit on spending, or the constitutional limit on revenue, is a more general term, but I think it is something that is easier for the voters to understand as a concept, not necessarily referring them to the specific provision, but it's easier for them to understand as a concept. Constitutional limit on spending. Okay, there's a limit in the Constitution on spending. I think it's much more accessible for the voters, and I think it makes it more fair and accurate. So if the board is wedded to having to put in a parenthetical, the only parenthetical I think would be appropriate would be the citation to the constitutional provision without any reference to Tabor or the taxpayer's bill of rights. I think it also opens a can of worms in terms of the future measures for this board. I mean, for example, the right to work provision that was approved, the ballot title does not contain the catchphrase right to work, even though the measure itself calls itself the Colorado Right to Work Act or measure. I'm not sure. So I think it is a catchphrase, and I think it has to be stricken for that reason.
Well, and maybe I'm going to belabor it just a little bit, and I appreciate what you're saying. I guess I'm still leaning in that direction, in the sense that Tabor is better than taxpayer bill of rights, because I see bill of, I mean, to me, I see that as a favorable connotation, bill of rights, you know, taxpayers' rights, as sort of inherently positive in a sense, whereas Tabor, it seems like that on its face means nothing, and may, in fact, may mean nothing to a lot of readers. If it means something at all, it might evoke something positive or negative. I don't know. I don't see anything inherently positive about that word, Tabor.
Well, I don't know if there's anything inherently positive or negative, but I think, you know, setting aside the people who don't know what it means, because it has mm-hmm. no effect on them, and it would just be superfluous. But if it evokes emotions pro or con, it causes a catchphrase problem. I think that's what the court's decisions say. They define a catchphrase as words which could form the basis of a slogan for use by those who expect to carry out a campaign for or against a measure. You know, you can see the ads coming up. Don't take away our Tabor refunds. I think it opens a campaign can of worms, so to speak, by including that language in the ballot title, rather than focusing on the merits of what the measure does to the operation of Tabor.
Okay. Well, and I guess that kind of leads into another issue that you raised, and that's the use of the word refund. And I was having trouble figuring out why, from your motion, you thought voters would confuse that with income tax refunds. But now I think I understand it. Because of that word together with taxpayers, the two might suggest a tax refund in a different sense.
Right. Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think you look at this ballot title, it's almost 250 words. Someone is reading it in the ballot booth. So we have ballot booths for this election. They're not going to be able to spend the kind of time they would really need to spend on it, and may not want to spend the kind of time on it. They may just read refund, particularly since taxpayer appears on the very next line, and say, wait, they want to take away my state tax refunds, I'll just vote no. And I think that does an injustice to what the measure does. It doesn't affect anybody's income tax refund. I think there is that danger that happen. So that's why we suggest taking out the term refund. And again, I go back to our language being completely accurate, fair, and shorter. And this ballot title certainly could stand to be shorter if possible.
Well, and I think my biggest problem with the elimination of the word refund is it seems like that eliminates half of what the board was trying to communicate to the readers. In other words, I think your proposal is to say requiring that the excess revenue be transferred to the state education fund, but that doesn't say instead of what. That doesn't tell the other side of the story that it's instead of a refund, which is what Tabor requires. And it seems like we would be hiding the fact that that refunds are being eliminated by this proposal.
Well, I think that if you read it that way, then I think we can just respectfully disagree on that. But I do think the phrase refund in that context, it does have the danger of being confused. That makes it misleading in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, and like I say, if in the context of saying taxpayers' bill of rights, maybe so, although to me that's another reason maybe for saying Tabor and instead of taxpayers' bill of rights, that at least helps address one of the reasons why you're concerned that readers might confuse it with a tax refund, an income tax refund.
And if the board is wedded to keeping that refund provision in there, then I think the better solution is just to strike the parenthetical completely so that there's no danger that it's going to be linked to kind of notion of income tax refund. Because there may be people who say, oh, I don't know what Tabor is. They look it up. They say taxpayers' bill of rights, and then they again associate it. It's misleading, maybe not as directly, but I think still.
Mr. Carton, any questions on this issue? Okay. Thank you. If you want to then go on.
So I think we've addressed that, which I think, frankly, that is the main issue that we needed to address. There is one phrase that needs to be corrected. Again, this is in paragraph 5 of my motion. It is the phrase that is, my failing eyesight can find it. It begins at line 8 for the 2010-11 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, creating a state education fund savings account. The dependent clause for the 2010-11 state fiscal year is inaccurate because the measure itself creates the state education fund immediately and then funds it in the 2009-2010 fiscal year. So that provision from the word for in line 8 through thereafter, comma, simply needs to be stricken.
Okay.
No questions on that. I can just come to the last part, which is where we actually propose another version of this, which incorporates our our suggested changes on the Tabor language, the necessary change on this issue, also reduces the two-thirds majority vote language. I know we had added the phrase two-thirds majority or requiring a bill. I can't remember the exact language that was adopted, but it seems to me that the language requiring a two-thirds majority vote is I don't think that's capable of. I mean, I guess if you parse it as a lawyer would, you could say, well, yeah, you could be referring to something. But I think the common voter is going to understand that the two-thirds majority vote is a two-thirds majority of both houses. You know, both houses have to have a two-thirds majority vote. That's so I think that language could be shortened. And then I suggested also taking out the notwithstanding clause. It begins, I think, down towards the bottom. Below what's on the screen, but it's the second to last line, notwithstanding any limitations on annual general fund appropriations. I don't know that that detail is necessary in what the board has, so I just suggested striking that for brevity, although if the board chooses to leave it in, that would be fine. So I think that's it for my changes. Now, does the board want to address those, or do you want me to go ahead and address the other comments that Representative Bruce made in his email?
Why don't you go ahead and move to Representative Bruce's objections.
Okay. On his first objection, which reads, for the record, on line 3 of the title, after to refund, add, quote, to Colorado taxpayers, close quote. Again, I think that would open the can of worms with income tax refunds and confusion there. So I think his suggestion there is not well taken and should be rejected. Number two, inserting the word permanently after transferred. It doesn't have a line reference, but I'm assuming that means the funds be transferred instead to the state education fund. I don't think permanently is necessary because it's self-executing, and there's no sunset provision, so I think that's understood in the provision itself. So permanently is not necessary, and frankly, it in itself have a problem of being a catchphrase. I think we've discussed the two-thirds vote requirement. Number four is the single subject requirement, which has already been rejected. And number five is on 126, which I understand we're addressing these at the same time, which is fine by me. And I think the undefined Colorado personal income, that would be misleading. I mean, there is an R statistics out there defining Colorado personal income. Those are the statistics that would be used. So I don't think the word undefined should appear. I think that is what I would call an advocacy word, trying to sort of say, look, this is going to be some unwieldy power for the General Assembly. So I don't think that was what it was. So I would reject all of his motion for rehearing and grant our motion for rehearing as stated.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Murray? I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on number 125 or number 126? If not, then I'll move to board discussion. Any discussion by the board? Mr. Carton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess initially, as far as the single subject argument that Representative Bruce has posited for 125 and 126, I again would respectfully disagree with him on his motion, and believe that both 125 and 126 contain a single subject that is accurately stated in the title for each measure that was set forth by the board at the last meeting. And I won't go over the arguments or my reasoning for that. That's just I would be inclined to deny that portion of Representative Bruce's motion, which I believe is paragraph 1 of both 125 and 126 of Representative Bruce's motion. As far as the language in 125, in the identical language in 126 that begins on line 3, requiring that any revenue that the state would otherwise be required to refund pursuant to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending, parent taxpayers' bill of rights, close parent, be transferred instead to the state education fund. and Mr. Myrie's arguments in support of modifying that. I do think that he's made some good arguments and stated some legitimate grounds for modifying the language of that title. As he's set forth in his motion, I did some of my own research, the word refund and taxpayer bill of rights does appear to be unprecedented in ballot titles for initiatives that have paper implications. I understand what you're saying, Mr. Chairman, as far as perhaps utilizing that terminology for purposes of further explanation and informing the voters. But I think that the examples of previous initiatives that Mr. Myrie has set forth in his motion are persuasive, or at minimum, striking the taxpayer bill of rights reference in the current title, and also may be supportive of removing the word refund. I also went back and again, the language of titles for measures that are referred by the General Assembly isn't necessarily dispositive of what the title board should do. But I went back and looked at the language of Referendum C, for example, and that was concerning the retention of state revenues in excess of the limitation on state fiscal year spending in Section 20, Parent 7 of Article 10 of the state constitution, and talks about retaining and expending revenues in excess of the constitutional limitation in a couple of different spots in that title. In the concurrent resolution, House Concurrent Resolution 08-1014, that was introduced this session and that 125 and 126 are modeled after, as I think I said the last time, the relevant language for this particular part of the measure was beginning with the 2010-11 state fiscal year, transferring any state revenues in excess of the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending to the state education fund. And so I do agree with Mr. Myrie that you don't appear to have any precedent for referring to taxpayers' bill of rights or TABOR or refund in previous measures. And to me, I think oftentimes the board talks about consistency and me, I think that there's legitimate, there may be, just putting this out for discussion, I think there's a legitimate reason to perhaps track the clause that Mr. Myrie's posited or something closer to what was in 1014 that doesn't reference taxpayer's bill of rights or refund. At minimum, if remainder of the board would be inclined to leave the word refund in there, I do think he's made a good argument for removing taxpayer bill of rights from that particular phrase. The other thing that I wanted to respond to Mr. Myrie on line 8 and 9, where his argument in paragraph 5 of his motion, that for the 2010-11 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, comma, creating a state education fund language, I think what happened there, Mr. Chairman, was when the board modified the title at the last title board meeting, the language that I just read on lines 8 and 9 preceded the language beginning on line 3. I think that staff draft said for the 2010-11 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, comma, requiring that any revenue that the state would otherwise be required. That's what the staff draft said, and I think that when the board moved the requiring that any revenue language up to follow the statement of the single subject, it left behind before the 2010-11 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter. So I agree with Mr. Myrie that particular phrase does not belong on lines 8 and 9, and we may want to consider bringing that, putting that back where it belongs. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I'm at as far as Mr. Myrie's motion. And with all respectfully, disagree with Representative Bruce and his arguments for the modifications to the language of the title of 125 and 126. I, I've reviewed those, and at this time I'm not inclined to make those changes.
Well, I agree with probably most of what you said, Mr. Carton. I agree that it's useful to look at House Bill 1014, and I guess, you know, consistent with my questions to Mr. Myrie, I'm pretty much persuaded that we ought not to say taxpayers' bill of rights in the title. I probably would prefer to substitute Tabor, as I indicated. But if there's not support for that, I would favor eliminating the parenthetical reference to taxpayers' bill of rights. I would prefer to keep the revenue or the refund language in the measure. I'm partly still trying to think that through in my mind just a little bit, because I was trying to figure out if my desire to keep that in there reflected a desire to inform the voters about an effect of a measure, which we don't normally do. We don't throw in mere effects. We don't interpret the measures generally to throw in the effects. But it seems to me that's probably not a fair characterization of this. As I indicated in my comments and questions with Mr. Myrie, I think this is really half the picture, and the measure itself says that, as I recall, that it's at the end of the measure it does say that any revenue that the state would otherwise be required to refund under that section shall be transferred instead to the state education fund, and I really feel like that's an important element of the measure, that the diversion of the Tabor refunds to the state education fund. So at this point I would prefer to keep the language in there about refunds, and I'm willing to to strike the reference to taxpayers' bill of rights, and then I think it sounds like that we should maybe insert at the beginning of that clause the reference, maybe this is what the board intended last time, to indicate that this diversion of Tabor refunds would begin with the 2010-2011 state fiscal year. But I would also support probably moving that up, as it sounds like we intended last time. There are two or three other changes that I think I would support that are raised in the motion, in Mr. Myrie's motion for rehearing. But maybe we could make some decisions with respect to that first clause, and before we get to those. And maybe for the sake of discussion, assuming, Mr. Carton, you're not willing to substitute Tabor, then I'll move that in line 4 of the title as displayed on the screen in the room, that we strike the parenthetical reference to taxpayers' bill of rights.
Second.
And Ms. Gomez is indicating those changes as we go. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Then, Mr. Carton, would you support then a motion to move the phrase about the fiscal year that's, down in line 8? That begins for the 2010-2011 state fiscal year and each fiscal year thereafter, moving that phrase up to the beginning of line 3.
So I'd support that.
I'll make that motion as Ms. Gomez makes that move. Yes. So then the after the phrase in connection therewith, it would begin for the 2010-2011 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, requiring that any revenues, etc. I'll move that change.
Second.
Further discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. The other changes that I'd like to bring up are further down in the measure. Mr. Carton, did you have anything further that you wanted to discuss in the first part of the measure there?
No.
There are several suggestions that Mr. Murray brought up that make sense to me. One that I'm relatively ambivalent about, but I think I'm okay with, is in line. And these are all in the nature of shortening the titles, which is a statutory consideration. And I think there are some potentially good suggestions here. I am looking for that part. Oh, I think it's at the end of line. Well, the beginning of line 10, the end of line 9, beginning of line 10, that says creating a state education fund savings account. Mr. Meyer's suggestion, I think, was to strike the phrase state education fund so that it would just say creating a savings account. I think what we have is accurate, but if we just said creating a savings account in the state education fund, I think it still flows. We refer in line end of line 11, beginning of line 12, to credited to the savings account. Line 13 uses the phrase savings account. I don't see any harm in striking that language. Comment, Mr. Garden? I'll go ahead and move that change then, as Ms. Gomez has shown it on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. The next change I'd like to bring up would be line 12, which says requiring a bill to be passed by a two-thirds majority vote. I think Mr. Murray's motion suggests striking the phrase a bill to be passed by. He might have gone further than that, but if we strike a bill to be passed by, what is left is a phrase that says requiring a two-thirds majority vote of the General Assembly. And so the issue is it significant to say that that two-thirds majority has to be expressed by bill? And it would take a few words out, but if that's not understood, I don't feel strongly about it.
No. I guess what I would say is that for purposes of the ballot title and specifically the presence of this particular phrase in the trailer to that title, that it's sufficient to have the language on line 12 that states requiring a two-thirds majority vote of the General Assembly without a specific reference to passing a bill or to a bill to be passed by, and that I think is consistent with the title board's effort to shorten the language of the title. So I heartburn over it.
Okay, then I'll go ahead and make that motion.
Second.
There's no other discussion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Then I think the last one that I think I would support would be line 16 and 17, striking the phrase, notwithstanding any limitation on annual general fund appropriations, comma.
I'd support that as well.
Okay. I mean, I don't think that's really necessary. I don't think anybody. I think without that, it still describes the effect of the measure. I'll move that change as Ms. Gomez has shown it on the screen.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. I don't have any other suggestions. I agree, Mr. Carton, with your comments about Representative Bruce's motion and with what Mr. Meyer said about those suggestions of Representative Bruce. Any other changes to the titles as set by the board? Good question. We've been looking at specifically the title for 125, and I guess I would. I think we better handle just 125. There is at least one difference, as I recall, in the title. So it's going to be a little awkward. We'll have to remember somehow if we're going to adopt the same changes in the title to 126. But so focusing now just on the titles for 125, if there are no other suggestions, I guess I will go ahead and move that the board deny both motions for rehearing, except to the extent that the board has amended the title to 125 with the understanding that the changes that we made in the title and what is now lines 1 through 18, I think, would be made also in the ballot title and submission clause, which is simply the same language in the form of a question.
Second.
If there's no other discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. That completes action on number 125. The time is 2:22 p.m. Then let's move to 126. Maybe the simplest thing to do is to consider the same changes with respect to the title that was previously set for number 126. I want to provide an opportunity if there's additional testimony then on 126. Mr. Meyer?
No, I think that it sums up, what we said in 125 sums up the changes to the assistant.
Okay. So maybe let's just mark the changes and then maybe a motion. So striking, and as Ms. Gomez has shown it on the screen, striking Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, moving the fiscal year reference in lines 8 and 9 to the beginning of line 3. Striking a bill to be passed by in line 12 of the title for 126, and then striking the language notwithstanding any limitation on annual general fund appropriations at the end. Mr. Murray.
Mr. Chair, if I could just bring up one point. I think that because of what we're doing to the language of bill passage, supermajority, line 14 there will be a superfluous or an by towards the end of the
okay.
sentence.
Okay.
Moving the phrase, a bill to be passed by either, we have an extraneous by next to a simple majority.
So just strike where the cursor is, strike the word by?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So that. Oh, yes. One other change Mr. Carton is pointing out. In line end of line, well, beginning of line 10, striking a savings account, creating a savings account. Yeah, strike state education fund, those three words. And let's actually, let me, I think I'll read that one into the record. I think that might help make sure that we've got it right. The 126, the changes that have been made before I offer a motion. With those changes, then, the title would read, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the manner in which the state funds public education from preschool through 12th grade, comma, and comma, in connection therewith, comma, for the 2010-11 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, comma, requiring that any revenue that the state would otherwise be required to refund pursuant to the constitutional limit on state fiscal year spending be transferred instead to the state education fund, comma, eliminating the requirement that, comma, for the 2011-12 state fiscal year and each state fiscal year thereafter, comma, the statewide base per pupil funding for public education from preschool through the 12th grade and the total state funding for all categorical programs increase annually by at least the rate of inflation, semicolon. I may have said a comma earlier, but I'll go with what's on the screen. I have trouble seeing semicolons. So picking up in line 9, creating a savings account in the state education fund, semicolon, requiring that a portion of the state income tax revenue that is deposited in the state education fund be credited to the savings account in certain circumstances, semicolon, requiring either a two-thirds majority vote of each house of the General Assembly or, comma, in each state fiscal year in which Colorado personal income grows less than 6% between the two previous calendar years, comma, a simple majority vote of the General Assembly to use the monies in the savings account, semicolon, establishing the purposes for which monies in the savings account may be spent, semicolon, establishing a maximum amount that may be in the savings account in any state fiscal year, semicolon, and allowing the General Assembly to transfer monies from the general fund to the state education fund, comma, so long as certain obligations for transportation funding are met. Mr. Carton.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chairman, line 12, it states in any state fiscal year, not, I thought I may have heard you said in each state fiscal year.
Okay. I probably misread it, so thank you for the clarification. It reads in any state fiscal year. I'll move those changes then to the title.
Second.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0. Then I'll move that the board, the understanding of course is that the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. Then I'll move that the board deny both motions for rehearing except to the extent that the board has amended the titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 2-0, and that concludes action on number 126. The time is 2:28 p.m. Thank you. Okay, let's move then to the next agenda item, which is 2007-2008, number 103, Colorado Housing Investment Fund, which is before us on the motion for rehearing. And again, I think I noted earlier that we had an email this afternoon from Representative Bruce adding to his motion for rehearing. Mr. Dunn, do you have that? Is that correct, that email?
Representative Bruce's? I didn't get the email today, no.
Do you have a copy of this?
I don't.
Let's want to make sure you get a copy, just a moment.
Do I need it?
Not at liberty to say. Yes, thank you. As Mr. Domenico points out, preliminarily I need to identify for the record now the title board members are myself, Bill Hobbs, and then to my immediate right, Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, appearing on behalf of Attorney General John Southers, to my immediate left, Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the Director's designee for number 103. I should have introduced at the beginning. To my far left is Maury Kneiser, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the title board, and to my far right is Ceci Gomez of the Secretary of State's Office. So with that, Mr. Dunn, I guess I would like to turn to your motion for rehearing.
Just reading Representative Bruce's email. I don't know if you want me to comment on that. Sorry, but I'm going to get to that later.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Jason Dunn. I'm with Brownstein Hyatt Farber Shekler here on behalf of the attorneys. This measure, of course, is similar to an initiative you've already seen this session or this term, Initiative 86, which we've discussed previously. I think when you peel back the folds of this measure and you look at what it really does, and you look at the terms closely and how they operate, you really see that there's a variety of separate subjects in the measure that are unconnected and have no necessary relation to each other. And in doing so, I've actually spent quite a bit of time on the internet researching affordable housing and what some of these terms mean and how sort of this industry operates. And I think when you look at some of these provisions, a more accurate way of describing what this measure does is that it imposes a real estate transfer tax to fund a host of social programs, one of which is affordable housing. But I think if you use that as a single subject or a title for the measure, that would obviously violate the single subject requirement. And so they've tried to couch it all under the umbrella of affordable housing. I think I have a handout that I actually just found last night on the internet looking at the proponents, I believe it's the proponents' website, and this isn't a smoking gun. Maybe one of those can be submitted for the record. And I think what the highlight is, and that came off the website for a website supporting this initiative. I think what the highlighted portion demonstrates is how this measure is intended to operate and talks about funding a variety of other programs and providing flexibility to fund programs that have nothing to do with affordable housing. How do they do that in this measure? I think the most broad provision and one that's perhaps the most hidden is the allowance for funding of permanent supportive housing. That phrase, as I learned in doing some research, is actually a term of art. It's not wasn't created for this measure, but it's a term used around the country in affordable housing and social services arena to provide a range of services that, I guess, almost an endless range of services for people who typically are homeless, but they include HIV and AIDS treatment. They include mental health services for severely people with severe mental problems. It includes alcohol and drug treatment, a variety of programs that really don't have anything to do with increasing how much affordable housing we have in the state of Colorado. And I have one other handout, which is actually from the state website, which I saw this morning. This is from the Colorado Department of Human Services website, and it's about a program that they call Shelter Plus Care. And it says, as you can see in the highlighted language, it's a permanent supportive housing program to provide services to people with serious mental illness, chronic problems with alcohol or drugs, and acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS, or related diseases. It says, for each dollar spent on housing assistance, an equal amount of supportive services must be provided. The applicants must have disabilities, and the program is designed to serve those with serious mental illness, chronic problems with alcohol and drugs, AIDS, and related diseases. It's interesting to note that this program is located not in the Division of Housing or the Department of Local Affairs, where housing issues are located. It's actually in the Department of Human Services, where social programs are housed for the state. The phrase permanent supportive housing reminds me a little bit of the immigration initiative, as you all recall from, I believe, 2006, if it was that long ago, in which the phrase used in that measure was non-emergency services, and the Supreme Court, in rejecting that measure as containing multiple subjects, said that the phrase non-emergency services was so broad and in some ways nondescript that the average voter would have no idea what type of services they were voting to deny to non-documented immigrants. The same thing holds for permanent supportive housing. I think when someone reads this measure, not the title, but the measure itself, they would have no idea the types of programs that they are funding by funding permanent supportive housing. And while they may support affordable housing, while they may support drug treatment, they might not support HIV/AIDS treatment, they might not support other types of programs that would be funded for this. It's the classic case of log rolling, where you use one idea to elicit support for other less popular measures in order to build coalitions or in order to get the support of other coalitions. The same is true for homelessness prevention, which is one of the concepts that can be funded through this tax. I think that measure is equally vague, and actually I'm not sure what the difference between permanent supportive housing and homelessness prevention are. I think that, you know, lots of homelessness programs fund all kinds of things like drug treatment and mental health services, counseling, child care, even payment of food. One of the interesting ones I came across actually as part of I think a homelessness program prevention program was landlord mediation. Third element, as we've discussed previously, of course, is the foreclosure prevention funding in this program. Again, that has nothing to do with affordable housing. They don't require any income level, even though the measure provides some definition. There is no connection between those definitions and who can benefit from foreclosure prevention. As Mr. Domenico and I sort of discussed last time, if you're someone who can afford a $1 million home and are in foreclosure problems, you can take advantage of these services, as well as anybody else who may be at a lower income level. Obviously, the money can go towards the state's foreclosure prevention hotline. Again, I think something that has nothing to do with affordable housing. In looking at each of these measures, I think the board has to ask a question. The Supreme Court asked in its analysis, which is, what is the necessary connection between each of these subjects? How is funding of a foreclosure hotline related to the funding of HIV and AIDS programs? How is the funding of landlord mediation connected to drug and alcohol treatment? I don't think there's a necessary connection there. There's a variety of other similar cases that the Supreme Court, and I won't go through all the descriptions and citations, but the Supreme Court has often, as you guys all know, talked about measures not being allowed to be grouped under one overarching theme or broad concept to mask the true impact and effect of a measure. The Supreme Court's rejected judicial personnel and judicial branch as a overarching umbrella. Of course, water in the Water Right 2 case, quote-unquote, limiting government spending was a rejected concept, as well as tax cuts and the non-emergency services from the immigration measure. I think with each of these provisions, the board has to ask, in order to get over the single subject hurdle, how does each of these measures increase the quantity of affordable housing in Colorado? Because that is what the proponents have stated is the purpose of this measure. If you can't answer that question for each of these provisions, then the matter, by definition, violates a single subject requirement. I also have issues regarding, as you know, in the motion for rehearing, regarding catchphrases and the setting of the title, but perhaps I'll stop there and let the board discuss the single subject issue.
Any questions for Mr. Dunn or comments about the single subject arguments? Mr. Domenico?
I think I agree with you that the Supreme Court has often talked about not being able to group different programs together under one theme. And they do sometimes use the language that the purposes or the objectives have to have there has to be some sort of necessary connection. But I don't think there's any case, except maybe the immigration measure, that actually says that simply because the objectives or the things that are being funded could be split up into different votes, that they have to be. That is, do you have any case that actually says that there has to be that they have to necessarily be connected to one another? Isn't that language usually tied to there's no necessary or rational connection between the two? Not that if the one can't be done without the other, that's enough for us to vote it down. I don't remember any of those cases.
I agree with the general principle you're stating. In fact, I think Justice Ide, in one of the cases from this year, I'm trying to remember a couple opinions they've already done this year, criticizes the majority for implying such a rule. In fact, I don't think there is such a rule that the measures must, if they can operate independently, then they must. I don't think that is the rule. The rule is whether there is a single purpose to the measure which connects all the provisions without actually going into a purpose that's so broad, such as water or the judicial branch, that sort of provides a false connection between them. And, you know, some of the examples I gave, if foreclosure prevention and a foreclosure funding of a foreclosure hotline and HIV/AIDS funding, how are those related? Well, I suppose in some cases they might relate both to people of low income. Well, we would like to propose a measure that supports people who have lower income. That's a single purpose and an accurate description, but I don't think that would satisfy the single subject requirement. That's just simply too broad.
Well, we've approved a large number of measures this year alone that do essentially what you're saying. The way you initially said we should start out looking at this is as a tax, an increase in a state tax, or creating a new form of taxation, and then using the revenue stream from that tax to accomplish a bunch of goals that aren't really tied to one another or to the tax. This year we've approved, 10, 20, 300 severance tax measures that do exactly that. And I do think there's a difficulty with those in that sense, but there seems to be a consensus so far that that's permissible. And those, the revenue streams in those measures are used for far more diverse types of purposes. I mean, under our analysis of all those severance tax measures, they could have this real estate transfer tax, do all these things, fund roads, provide college scholarships, and I don't know what else they've got in some of those, couldn't they? I mean, wouldn't your argument mean that we were wrong on all those severance tax measures, at least on the single subject topic?
I think some would say yes. But, you know, I can't speak to those. I haven't studied those measures and look how they operate. But you know, I do think that when you have measures that use one funding source and they're only joined because the funding source is coming from the same place and have no other connection, then I think that does violate the single subject.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that some would say that. I wish we would get some clear guidance, because I'm not clear on that. But I think these are I think you may be right. They're not all. You're definitely right that they're not all design. All the purposes don't go to increase the quantity of what's a term of art, affordable housing, or a defined term, affordable housing. You're right about that. But to me, I think that suggests maybe we need to reconsider the title rather than find a single subject violation. That's where I am at the moment, at least.
I suppose the opposite rule is that, or the rule is that, as long as you have one funding source, there is no such thing as a single subject requirement. You can have any number of subjects as long as they're connected by a single funding mechanism, which, of course, most
that seems
proposals are.
To me, to be the rule we've de facto adopted, that if you're going to raise a tax, you can then decide what you want to spend it on. And I agree that that's problematic. You know, but even under what I've sort of thought of as a intermediate rule, which is you can raise a tax that in which either all the uses the money is going towards are related to the impacts of the activity you're taxing, or they're related to one another, it would seem to me that this would survive under that kind of a intermediate rule, because they are all related in some sense to providing services that help people either obtain housing or stay in housing, and decrease sort of the decrease some of the creative destruction of the housing market. They do seem at least related to one another in that sense, if not all being related to increasing the quantity of affordable housing, aren't they?
You know, I think that depends. The example I gave about someone of any income class being able to take advantage of the foreclosure hotline, I suppose in essence that relates to their housing. Right? I don't think that relates to affordable housing, depending on your perspective. Again, landlord mediation, I suppose anybody of income level can take advantage of that. Credit counseling, mental health services. I suppose at the end of the day, everything has to do with housing, because if you can't earn sufficient living, if you can't function in society because you have mental health problems or because you can't eat, everything has to do with housing. And I think that just can't possibly be a breadth that's allowed by the single subject requirement.
Well, but I mean, this doesn't. This is at least a little bit more focused than saying, well, we're also going to be building a bunch of new schools, and since that's important to prevent housing, and we're going to pay for new road construction because that'll provide jobs for people. I mean, it's not quite that they're trying to just throw everything under the sun under the theory that it somehow helps keep someone in a house. They are tied a little bit more closely together than that, aren't they?
Well, sure, I think some of the elements are. But I think the question you guys have to resolve is, what is the single subject of this measure? And is there a necessary connection? Not can you come up with any connection, can you come up with something so broad that connects them, but are these subjects, are these purposes, as the Supreme Court talks about, dependent on each other or necessarily related to each other? And they're simply not. I think it's providing funding for just a host of social services. That's why these programs are housed in the Department of Human Services. And I think, you know, while, sure, it doesn't include roads or schools, it includes a lot of other things. It includes, a lot of the ones I listed, I won't repeat them, but, I think paying for someone's food is can be included under permanent supportive housing. I think there's a host of things that I'm probably not thinking of and the board's not thinking of that are typically funded through these programs that really have nothing to do with increasing affordable housing.
Further comments or questions on that issue? Ms. Eubanks?
Thank you. I don't know that these are arguments that we haven't heard before on the previous measure, but I think it's important to focus on what we've set as the single subject of this measure, which is to expand the availability of affordable housing. And when you look at some of these items that Mr. Dunn has brought to our attention in his motion for rehearing, while I understand his argument, I think you can also make the argument that these are purposes that go towards expanding the availability of affordable housing. I mean, it seems that, for example, when people have their houses foreclosed, it's because they can't afford to pay their mortgage anymore. And so by whatever those programs are, you're allowing them to be able to afford the house that they're in currently rather than losing it. In terms of homelessness prevention programs, in terms of providing the types of actual housing for folks who would otherwise be homeless, as well as the services that those folks generally need to try to get them on their feet again so that perhaps they can provide their own housing rather than being in a homeless shelter. In terms of some of the social programs, there's folks, I mean, I think if you think of, affordable housing or housing just as the housing unit, that's one thing, but there's folks that need housing that they can't live in a housing unit by themselves because of their illness, because of certain physical conditions, mental conditions. They need what I'd almost classify as assisted living. I mean, that they need housing where they're provided some services to allow them to be able to live in that housing. And so, to me, while I understand Mr. Dunn's argument, and I agree with Mr. Domenico that, we haven't gotten a lot of guidance from the court on when you have multiple things that are being funded, especially from a tax increase or a fee increase, that I think there can be reasonable arguments made that the provision of these types of services, they all relate to expanding the availability of affordable housing to different groups and different needs. I mean, but it's all going to affordable housing in different types of housing depending on the situation that folks may be in. And so I'm of the position, at least on single subject, that I think that we've described the single subject of the measure and the fact that these types of services and programs are part of the housing that is provided through the initiative, I think it constitutes a single subject.
Yes, sir.
You know, I think if you had an initiative that was designed to raise funding for permanent supportive housing, and it included a list of those types of programs that it was going to fund, I think that might be acceptable. But that's only one subject. I think this does a host of other things that are unrelated to fulfilling that subject, the purpose of that subject, whether it's foreclosure programs, whether it's homeless programs, all the affiliated services. The Initiative 55 opinion raised the question of using the phrase non-emergency services, not in the title for purposes of vagueness or anything else, but actually said that phrase was so vague in itself as part of the measure that someone actually reading the measure would have no idea all the types of things that would encompass. It wasn't even a title-setting issue. And I think the same thing is here. If you had a proposed initiative that was about just nothing more than permanent supportive housing and spelled out all the types of services, someone could understand that and say, that's probably a single subject because they're part and parcel of one type of program. When you add in, number one, you don't disclose all those types of programs, and it creates an opportunity for deception of the voter. And number two, when you combine it with, I think, what are unrelated measures, that's where I think you get into single subject problems.
Well, I'll just make a quick comment that I tend to agree with Ms. Eubanks and Mr. Domenico, basically, is that I think I understand that this is a harder area. I think, Mr. Dunn, I think these are good questions. I think I can see a connection. I can see that the proponents can make a reasonable connection between the various services and affordable housing. I'm just not there yet that I can see something that stands out as being unconnected. And I'm influenced by, as Mr. Domenico pointed out, the severance tax cases, where I see there we have separate purposes, a tax increase and separate purposes that are much harder to connect to to each other or to a single purpose, and it's just hard for me to see how this board could find a single subject violation having set titles for the severance tax, for some of the severance tax proposals. I do agree that we may need to do something better with the titles themselves, but I'm just not there yet on the single subject violation.
I don't know on the severance tax measure. Like I said, I haven't read those in a while, but I think Mr. Domenico intimated that they're connected not so much by the programs themselves, but because they are impacts of severance of minerals and gas themselves, whether it's schools or roads or other types of services. Are all the result of those type of the severance of natural resources. I don't think you have that connection here.
Okay.
Well, I guess I should just say that I do think this measure has at least this. If we were to apply the Initiative 55 analysis to this measure, it would be hard not to vote it down. But if we were to apply the Initiative 55 analysis to almost any measure, it would be hard not to vote it down. This does contain certain little terms of art that are difficult, that may not jump out at the average reader, and therefore under 55 would be some sort of a second surreptitious subject, but it just seems to me that the court has not generally enforced that rule, and it's difficult to square it with many of the other decisions the court and this board has made, and so I have some sympathy for that argument, but I just can't figure out how to apply it in a coherent way. Well, you may see if you can convince the court to start applying it more often. But this year they seem to be going the other direction. So I'm not sure I agree with Ms. Eubanks that these are all related to what we've stated currently in the title as the subject, but I do think they are all related to one another. And so on the single subject issue, I'm probably ready to move on, I think.
You want to go on to your other arguments, Mr. Dunn?
With regard to the title?
Yes.
The only other single subject one was, as we talked about in 86, is the definition of affordable housing, which, while sort of used in other parts, is not actually used as the term of art as it's defined in anywhere else in the measure. And I think for the same reasons that the inflationary mandate on the General Assembly in Initiative 86 was, at least by Ms. Eubanks, was found to be a separate subject, I think the same thing holds here. It's a definition provided in the measure that really has no import to the measure itself, and therefore, almost by definition, creates a second subject.
Okay. Okay. If you want to, unless there's comments or questions, then why don't you go on to, I think it's catchphrases. Is that the next part
okay.
of your argument?
It is. I think all those arguments actually that apply to single subject apply to why the phrase affordable housing is a catchphrase. I think actually, Mr. Hobbs, you said it best in the discussion you just had on 125 and 126 that it's an inherently positive phrase, I think, that might create voter sympathy without actually understanding what the measure does. And obviously the measure involves much more than just affordable housing, which is why, of course, we think it's a second subject, but at a minimum, it is a catchphrase that I think is could elicit sympathy for the measure for those who might support one type of program without knowing what the rest of the measure does.
Well, let me ask you about that. I didn't mean to say probably that merely being positive was a catchphrase. I mean, I think as, you know, to be a little more exact, I guess it's a phrase that may be positive but also does not contribute to voter understanding. And I'm not sure that I see these phrases as catchphrases. I guess I'm looking at a couple of cases that to me are somewhat similar. The court upheld the phrase protect the environment and human health in 1998 in number 112. Protect the environment and human health sounds like a pretty positive thing, but doesn't to me that doesn't seem like a catchphrase. Another one was the court in number 256 in the 99-2000 cycle upheld the phrase management of growth. Again, probably sounds like a positive thing to do to a lot of people. No, I don't know that it's everybody, but it was. It seemed like, and the court said there that was a neutral phrase that have none of the hallmarks of catchphrases. And
I think I would have a lot less issue with it if it were part of a laundry list types of services that are provided on the measure rather than being used as a catchphrase for everything that's provided by the measure.
So it's kind of the umbrella effect that is the phrase coupled with the way it serves as an umbrella for related services. Is that
right,
the problem?
I think it tries to use an oversimplified phrase as a catchphrase to encompass all kinds of services that may or may not
Yeah, I mean, the problem I have with using it, especially using it as the in the single subject statement, is that I think not only does it not contribute to voter understanding, it detracts from it. It's confusing because, in fact, unless you use sort of a very counterintuitive interpretation of either the phrase expand the availability of or of affordable housing, which I think has sort of a basic basically accepted meaning, there's a lot. Mr. Dunn's right that there's a lot going on here that doesn't expand the availability of affordable housing. And to that extent, I'm not sure affordable housing is quite a catchphrase in the sense that just by its very nature can't be used in a title, but that using it in this way is misleading in the sense that it really does give the impression, if you just read the title, that what you're doing is raising money to help pay for housing that's affordable to low-income people, probably would be the natural interpretation of what affordable housing means. And there really is a lot going on here that I think doesn't relate to that. And the money would be used for a lot of things that doesn't cover. And so I was thinking that you could perhaps change the title to say something along the lines of creation of a real estate transfer tax to fund housing-related programs or something along those lines. Because it really does sort of stretch the meaning of affordable housing to pay for homelessness, drug programs, or to pay for foreclosure, anti-foreclosure programs for upper or middle class people is not what I think anyone would consider, at least what I would consider, to be the natural meaning of the phrase expanding the availability of affordable housing. I mean, Mr. Dunn sort of pushes it a little too far when he says, in fact, that by preventing foreclosures and by helping homeless people be able to afford housing, you're actually constricting the availability of affordable housing. I mean, that's perhaps a little too cute, but in fact, it is true that by increasing the ability of people to afford housing, you decrease, who otherwise wouldn't be able to, you decrease the amount of housing, you increase the demand and the price. And so I don't think all of these expand the availability of affordable housing, and I think it's misleading for us to say so, if not quite a catchphrase.
Okay, if there's no other discussion or questions, you want to go on, Mr. Dunn?
Sure. I think it creates a legitimate problem for you guys on how, obviously I agree with Mr. Domenico, but then how do you phrase that in a single subject? Mm-hmm. Maybe you can do it more easily in the remainder of the measure, the laundry list. But I think that goes back to the single subject issue, not the federal ground.
Well, I do like what Mr. Domenico suggested, or something along those lines. It does strike me that our expression of the single subject is too limited. But as you just said, there's also the issue of have we said enough as well in the trailers about what kinds of services are involved here?
Yeah, I guess I would, maybe you can read that phrase again that you suggested.
Well, my suggestion was just something along the lines of creation of a real estate transfer tax to fund housing-related programs. I'm not wedded to that, but that was my suggestion.
I'm more inclined to accept something like that if you do include the types of programs, because I think even with that, people would not understand full breadth of the measure and the types of programs it covers. If you accomplish that through the rest of the title, then maybe it will. That alone probably wouldn't get there. I also think, just as a small point, since we're on that sentence, that I think the measure really ought to talk about an imposition of a real estate tax rather than the creation, because there are a lot of, but 6, 8, 10 municipalities that actually have real estate transfer taxes. And so, I think it creates a misconception that it's creating for the first time the real estate tax, when some folks will actually have this layered over the top of the transfer tax they're already paying.
Okay. Then with respect to the other issues involving the titles.
Well, I think about the section on the title being misleading, I think a lot of those are issues we've already discussed as far as the types of services. Some of the other smaller points, I think, you know, with regard to stating in the title the 4 cents for each $100 paid, I think it makes sense to describe that in a way that the person doesn't have to sit there on the side of their ballot and kind of figure out how much that's going to cost on their house or the average house. I think it makes more sense, given that the average home price in the state is $200,000+, to state it in some fashion of $100,000 increment. I suggested in the motion that it be stated as $40 per $100,000. I think 90% of all real estate transactions are home purchases, so that seems to make sense and be most informative to the voters. And again, with regard to the phrase $100 paid or whatever increment paid, it's important that people know that this measure applies not just to home purchases, but anything that involves transactions of real property, whether it's land swaps or else that they'll have to pay this fee. So I think the use of the phrase consideration is probably more accurate. The last two, number five and number six, I guess this goes to point about listing some of the programs that are covered, but the measure allows for the tax to go to large-scale renewable energy projects, solar panel fields, biomass projects, thermal energy projects. I think the voters ought to be made aware that that's a type of services that can be provided as well. And finally, I think it's important to disclose in the title that the state is going to get into the lending business, not already in some other arena, but that they will enter the lending business with regard to affordable housing. That sometimes is a higher risk of venture, and I think people ought to know that the state is engaging in that type of conduct. That's all I have.
Questions for Mr. Dunn? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Murray, would you like to comment on the motions for rehearing? Representative Bruce's motion does bring up capital letters. So maybe I'd like for you to respond to that as well, but just to maybe to focus your comments on that part of it. Although maybe I'll come back to that. Let me bring that up as after you've had a chance to respond to Mr. Dunn's motion for rehearing.
Well, on the single subject, I think we've gotten a little far afield on what the purpose of this initiative is. A lot of reference to programs. I guess he derives from research on the internet about permanent supportive housing. I think if you look at the measure itself and some of the assistance that's provided in the measure, and this is section 2 of the provision, which explains how the Housing Investment Fund is to be used. Grants and loans to support the statewide creation and preservation of affordable housing stock through, and then list these various services, all of which relate to the creation and preservation of affordable housing stock. Now, the argument that if you put a homeless person into a unit of housing, you somehow created a problem or reduced the availability of affordable housing stock, I think is being too clever, because all programs intended to keep people in their house, or intended to get people into new housing, is all intended to create affordable housing opportunities for the force, whether it's the workforce household, very low-income household, or the low-income households. And that's what this measure intends to do. So the measure creates the means for, creates the fund, and the fund provides these affordable housing opportunities. And maybe that's the solution on the title, is to change the availability of affordable housing to the availability of affordable housing opportunities. You take the person in foreclosure that we've heard so much about. The person who's in foreclosure, his home is no longer affordable. It is unaffordable housing. The way he can turn that around is someplace else, be foreclosed, get a rental unit, or if he can get foreclosure assistance, his formerly unaffordable house because of high mortgage payments, because it's upside down in terms of equity or what have you, now becomes affordable. So these programs all tie in just as a matter of single subject. That also, I think, plays right into the title when we're talking about the availability of affordable housing.
Well, can I stop you right there?
Yes.
I mean, if I mean, that can't, if we had a measure that said we want to spend a bunch of money on affordable housing, and what it really did was give money to rich people to help build rich people houses, because then they could afford these nice new houses. Don't you think that would be misleading for us to say this is about affordable housing? I mean, affordable housing has kind of a generally understood meaning to have something to do with generally with lower income people who typically can't afford a house. Not just that affordable housing is affordable to whatever person happens to want the house, right?
And that's why the measure breaks it down into low-income, very low-income, workforce household. People of more modest means than the rich person, whether it's Isaacson, Rosenbaum, or Brownstein.
Right.
Talk about the really rich.
Yeah.
Who are seeking foreclosure assistance. That's not what this does. I mean, it that's why it has these definitions. The rich person is not going to be getting foreclosure assistance through this program. I don't think they can, because I don't think that's an affordable housing opportunity for residents of the state from very low-income households, low-income households, and workforce households. That person wouldn't qualify. So I don't think that's what this measure does.
Well, where's that limit?
It's in the creation of the fund. It talks about the purpose of creating the fund. Is section one? It's in section 3.1. Colorado Housing Investment Fund, creation, use, and allocation. One, to provide affordable housing opportunities for residents of the state from very low-income households, and workforce households, the Colorado Housing Investment Fund is hereby created. So that's the purpose behind creating it. And then we talk about affordable housing stock, which is, again, a defined term, which means safe and sanitary shelters, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, affordable rental or affordable ownership units, and housing for people with special needs. The purpose of the measure targets a segment of society that has a hard time making ends meet for whatever reason, and therefore have a difficulty having their housing needs be affordable to them. And it is not, Mr. Dunn would have it, vision that would allow foreclosure prevention for somebody with a $2 million ranch somewhere. That's not what this provision would address. It simply doesn't.
So so the purpose would sort of limit the ability to use to create kind of a general foreclosure prevention. A generally available foreclosure prevention or that sort of thing?
Right. It's targeted at the affordable housing opportunities for these types of households, ones defined that are of more modest means. And I think another thing to point out is that this is being administered by the fund administrator, which means, under the definitions, the Division of Housing. We're not talking about human services. We're talking about housing. I think that is, not only is a single subject matter, but it's an interpretive matter. It is important. It's the housing, Division of Housing, that's going to be administering this fund for the purpose of providing these affordable housing opportunities, creating and preserving affordable housing stock.
So how's the Division of Housing supposed to do that through homelessness prevention? I'm just curious what the proponents foresee that being used for.
If it's all right, I'll defer to Ms. Fisher, who I believe spoke at the 6, because she's the expert in this.
That'd be great.
Hi, I'm Britta Fisher. I'm the chair of the Colorado Housing Investment Fund Coalition. I think broadly it's important to state that affordable housing, when you look at the definition in the measure, relates to a household's ability to afford housing, meaning spending no more than 30% of their gross household income on housing costs. I think it's also important to note that affordable housing opportunities refers to all of the ways in which housing can be made affordable throughout the housing continuum. So we're looking for everything from the ability to keep a roof over someone's head and not be homeless, all the way to home ownership, and that is a broad continuum for very low income, and workforce households. What that looks like, the Division of Housing currently makes grants and loans, and they currently make those to the allowable entities that are listed here in the measure. If you go to Section 3, Number 4A1, that it shall be available on a competitive basis to any local housing authority, public nonprofit, private for-profit or nonprofit corporation, local government, or special district. The state will be administering those funds through grants and loans to those entities, which will provide the creation and preservation of affordable stock through these activities that are listed in Section 3.2, which include the new construction, acquisition of real property, pre-development, defraying costs, building rehabilitation, assistance with down payments and closing costs, energy efficiency improvements, accessibility modifications, and foreclosure and homelessness prevention. So these are already activities that the Division of Housing can currently engage in. So if there is a nonprofit, like, say, the Colorado Housing Assistance Corporation, which provides down payment assistance and closing cost assistance, the state could make a grant or a loan to that entity to provide that kind of assistance, the down payment assistance, to any very low income, or workforce households. Does that make sense?
I think so. I mean, I think it's clearer to me that these are going to be sort of means-tested programs, almost all of them, right? I mean,
what do you mean by means?
Well, I mean the only ones that seem to Mr. Dunn seems to be suggesting can be kind of available to everyone. Maybe sort of the foreclosure prevention program, or maybe some of the sort of the phrase he used about permanent supportive housing that are kind of could be available to do a lot of things for anybody that don't have to do with helping keep poor people in their homes. And go ahead.
Just to talk about permanent supportive housing for a second, since it seems to get a lot of discussion. It's really just one of the types of affordable housing stock that are available. And permanent supportive housing is only available to the chronically homeless, to the very largely at-risk homeless population. They're not of any other income but very low income, so they definitely fit within this measure. However, it's also important to look at the definition of permanent supportive housing. Mr. Dunn provided to you about a specific program called Shelter Plus Care. That's not language that you see in our measure. You see permanent supportive housing, and I can provide to you from the Corporation for Supportive Housing what that is. My husband and I like to joke that I had to stay up last night because someone was on the internet and they were wrong. you can find a definition for anything, but if you look for the proper sources, such as the Corporation for Supportive Housing, it really means that it's a unit that's available to or intended for a person or family whose head of household is homeless. It talks about the unit. It talks about them not paying more than 30% of their household income. I can provide this to you too, Mr. Dunn. It talks about having a lease. It doesn't talk about paying for the services that way. It talks about the housing. And the housing can have services associated with it. That's just what permanent supportive housing is. But we can pay for the housing stock and that's one of the types of housing stock.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mari.
I don't know if you want me to address Representative Bruce's motion for rehearing.
Well, let me give you some thoughts on just from my personal perspective, and then again, then maybe you could respond to that, because I would like to know what proponents, whether they would like all titles or all capitals in the title. The requirement of Tabor, which I think this is built on, says that ballot titles for tax or bonded debt increases shall begin, and then in all caps it says shall taxes be increased, et cetera, et cetera. I think the practice has been on the ballots themselves, Tabor-related measures have been in all caps, and other measures have been in lowercase. There is a rule of the Secretary of State, Rule 10.1, that says the text of ballot issues that are subject to Tabor shall be printed in all capital letters, and other ballot issues and names of candidates and so forth shall be printed in upper and lower case. The practice, and I think Representative Bruce is raising basically a question about the application of all capitals to three different stages of the title setting process. One is title setting by the title board. The second is when the Secretary of State's office approves the format of petitions. And then the third, when the Secretary of State certifies the ballot content to county clerk and recorders. Those last two really are not issues for the title board, but the question is, to what extent should there be any variation? I mean, the practice of the title board has been, I believe, not to consider the issue per se. I did find back in 2000 the minutes of the meeting summary of the title board where the title board had a discussion about whether to differentiate which measures would have all capitals in the titles and which would not. And at that time, the consensus of the title board was to use lowercase rather than all capitals when the board considers titles, for the reason that lowercase is easier to read. And the meeting summary says it's then anticipated that the Secretary of State may nevertheless continue the practice of putting titles for Tabor measures in all capitals when the Secretary of State certifies titles to the ballot. So that's been the practice. I mean, personally, I don't know that I have any problem with the title board making at least a preliminary distinction between what it thinks is a Tabor-related measure and what it thinks is not. I guess I would not, normally that's not the focus. That can be a little bit more complicated. It's not necessarily in every case an easy decision. I don't recall good examples, but I do know sometimes the Secretary of State has struggled a bit, and that does require looking at Article 41 of Title I, which helps define, as I recall, matters arising under Article 10, Section 20. But it may be more consistent if the title board would make at least a guess at that in setting the titles. I'm not sure it's really that whether the printing is in all capitals or in a particular font or those kinds of things is necessarily the duty or responsibility of the title board to set the language of the titles. But like I say, I don't have any objection to it, and it might simplify things if the title board did go ahead and if it thinks that something is a Tabor-related measure, go ahead and use all capitals. That would might make everybody, it might just simplify the process. I guess I would, from the point of view of an employee of the Secretary of State's office, I might want to reserve some belief that, that the Secretary of State might end up, based on further analysis, with a different interpretation. But I'm kind of inclined to go along with Representative Bruce's suggestion, and I'm just curious what the proponents feel.
We have no objection. I mean, that's the way it will appear on the ballot. We have no objection to it appearing in all caps. I agree it's harder to read, but we have no objection to it.
And yeah, and this one I think is probably pretty clear. I don't write off. I don't see that this is a gray area at all. But,
I request that we just do it at the very end so we can do our editing in the normal
that
writing.
Okay.
Are there any other questions on?
I don't, Representative Bruce in his email had another another issue, but I'm not sure I understood what it was. He wanted to amend the title to add the phrase repealing the current constitutional prohibition in the taxpayer's Bill of Rights in letter N such taxes. But I, right off, I'm not sure what that's referring to.
Well, Ms. Eubanks, I suspect like what he wants to do is to add that somewhere after the creation of real estate transfer tax. But, you know, based on our discussion this morning about 125, I think that language would create problems, again, with the catchphrase taxpayers' Bill of Rights. And I don't think it's necessary because the creation, I mean, if approved, the creation of the real estate transfer tax of the provision by its terms would repeal that constitution. I don't think that's necessary because the creation of the real estate transfer tax accomplishes that. So I think this would just add to the confusion, to the length, and would also include an impermissible catchphrase.
Ms. Eubanks?
Just to try to help understand and what Representative Bruce might be arguing in terms of his motion for rehearing is there is currently a provision in Article 10, Section 20, Subsection 8. The first sentence under Paragraph A, it says, new or increased transfer tax rates on real property are prohibited. And so that, I believe, is the current constitutional provision in the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights on such taxes that I think he's referring to in his motion for rehearing. I don't know that I'm inclined to include that phrase because I don't think this measure is repealing the prohibition. I think that by voters approving, if they were to approve this particular initiative, this would then be an exception to that prohibition. But I think the prohibition would exist still for all local governments or for the General Assembly to do something by ordinance or by statute, that they could not do that constitutional prohibition. I view this measure as more of creating an exception by authorizing a new real estate transfer tax rather than repealing the current constitutional prohibition, if that's helpful.
It is. It makes sense to me.
Are there any questions on Mr. Dunn's issues?
I don't think so.
Guess not. Thank you. Mr. Dunn, did you want to briefly respond to any of Mr. Meyer's arguments?
No, I think the issues have been pretty fleshed out on the single subject. I will say, you know, this is probably moot at this point, but the measure may talk about a purpose of providing affordable housing opportunities for residents from low-income households, very low-income households, and workforce households. But there's no requirement that those are the only people who can receive benefits. And one of the issues I'm still wrestling with this is that you have both a definition of affordable housing, which refers to a person's ability to afford a specific house as being 30% of, no more than 30% of gross household income for housing-related expenses, And if you do apply that in Section 3, to provide affordable housing opportunities, so it's saying to provide opportunities for people who spend no more than 30% of their income on housing-related services, but then it says for residents of the state from very low-income households, low-income households, and resident households, which are definitions of how much those people make. And I'm not sure how
that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah,
that means...
I guess you have to meet both criteria. You have to both spend less than 30% of your income and fit within one of those groups.
Well, no. What it would mean is you fit within one of those groups, and the programs are supposed to provide opportunities for you to get, in some fashion, housing opportunities that only require you to spend 30% or less of your income, right? Not that you have to already be spending less than that in order to be eligible. But
well, I guess it's a moving scale. Then I mean, workforce household is defined as someone who can earn as much as 120% of the area median income.
Right.
I guess it's the idea of to get sort of those.
That's for people who live in Vail and Aspen, and
right,
that where the average income is like $6 million a year, right?
I guess.
But.
You know, and then on Representative Bruce's second email, I guess. You know, I agree that it's not repealing generally that provision. I think she makes it right. Certainly, it does override that too. So, to the extent that the board doesn't typically include language in a title, it has not only the substantive effect but also for overriding another provision that I guess doesn't need to be included. So, I wouldn't disagree with that. I don't know if we want to go back to specific drafting. I can sit down and let you guys work on that.
I think that's where I was headed next, is for the board to discuss the titles. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? And let's turn to possible changes to the title.
Well, I still don't really like the way it is now. I think the measure does a lot of things that aren't. The measure allows the money to be used for a number of things that don't really expand the availability of affordable housing. And the suggestion from the proponents that it be changed to expand opportunities for affordable housing is sort of, it's not, that I guess I don't think is misleading in the same way that the current one is, but I think it's a little, I don't know that it is meaningful enough. And I sort of liked at least the part of my suggestion that referred to funding programs, and how you define those programs may be where we could play around with it a little bit. But I think creation of a tax, and I guess while I mention that on creation, I understand Mr. Dunn's suggestion that may change. Some people already pay a real estate transfer tax, but and I'm okay with imposition, but I think I'm also okay with creation. In the sense that it's pretty clear that this is a statewide tax, and so it in fact does create a new real estate transfer tax, and so I don't think it's incorrect as it is. So I'm willing to go either way on that one. But I think it should say something about creation of a tax to fund certain programs, and then if there's suggestions about how to describe it, I thought housing-related programs is pretty good. It is indeed fairly broad, housing-related, but I don't think it's so broad as to bring us within the water-type problem or the judicial branch or whatever the other one that's caused problems in the past. And so I still would stick with that suggestion for the for that that part of the title.
And as I indicated, I unless somebody comes up with a better idea, I think it might be better to adopt, Mr. Domenico, your suggestion of just to fund housing-related programs. But there may be a better way, but I think that broadens it enough to where I feel better about the expression of the single subject along those lines. Maybe for the sake of discussion, I'll move that.
I'll second it.
So I guess we are proposing to strike the phrase expand the availability of affordable housing. Well, and maybe, I don't know, stop before housing and insert to the words fund housing hyphen related. I'm sorry, the housing is there, to fund housing hyphen related purposes. Programs, I'm sorry, programs. That's the motion. Mr. Meyer, would you like to comment on that?
I think by striking the word affordable, setting aside the addition of related programs, what we now have is the creation of a real estate transfer tax to fund housing-related programs. There's no tether to the nature of this being provisioned for the poor or the people of modest means. It's just housing-related programs. I think that is mischaracterize the title, and I would suggest you add the term affordable housing-related programs, because I think that takes care of the concern that, you know, just the affordable housing is kind of nebulous and ties it to programs that are related to affordable housing, which I think it's clear in this provision that all these quote programs are related to providing affordable housing as used in the measure. So I think in order to be accurate, it has to say affordable housing related.
I'm just not sure that I agree. I mean, from what I think I followed of the discussion about that, among the points that were influencing me were that affordable housing, although I don't think that's really a catchphrase, but I think a reader understands affordable housing to refer to the cost of housing. And I'm afraid it's a little misleading to say that it's. I understand that you want to get back to maybe the focus on income and so forth, but I'm troubled by tying this to affordable housing related programs because I'm not sure it's the cost of housing. And maybe I'm mistaken about that. But the other thing that was sort of influencing my feeling about this was I thought what Ms. Fisher said was pretty influential. I mean, it sounds like the Division of Housing deals with all of these things now. That are in kind of the laundry list, and so I feel like the Division of Housing, it's not the Division of Affordable Housing, to be real basic about it. I don't know for sure what their mission is, what their statutes are, but the mere label Division of Housing being responsible for these kinds of programs makes me think that this is relating to housing programs. Mr. Domenico?
I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, I'm done.
Okay.
That's it.
I've actually, this was my idea, but I've come around to further discussion. I'm getting pretty close to where you are, I think. And my question is it your position that under this, if this were to go into effect, if this were to become law, no money that's brought in from this tax could be used for any programs beyond any programs that pay for anything that's not that isn't related to housing where the total costs are no more than 30% of a whoever it's serving's gross income?
That's correct. That's what affordable housing is, and all these programs tie into the provision of affordable housing by various means.
Right. I mean, I agree. That's what affordable housing is. It's just from reading it, it's not 100% clear to me that there's no way that money that is given out under the structure created by this measure could be used for anything else. That's my concern, and we talked about it a little bit, and I just want to make, I think if I were completely assured that that was the case, I would be willing, and I would probably agree with you that the title would be better if it said if we inserted affordable there, but I'm not quite 100% certain of that, and so I'm just looking for assurance that there's no way that any of these grants can be used for kind of more general programs or anything like that. And if you can assure me of that, I may be willing to insert affordable.
Well, and I think that it's exactly what this is intended to do. I mean, the money goes to the fund and is distributed to 40% is available for local housing authority, and then 60% is available for local governments. There are needs assessment. If you look at, I'm looking at section 3.4. There's needs assessment that goes at the local level, and I believe there's also needs assessment. I don't see the needs assessment provision in there, but it's allocated. And so, you know, with the exception of funds going to fund the fund itself, in other words, the administrative costs.
Right.
The money all goes to affordable housing programs. It needs to be circular, but that's where it goes. Now, exactly how that gets allocated among the various programs, affordable housing-related programs, is something for the Division of Housing, and then for the local governments based on the grants or loans that they get. But it's all affordable housing-related programs to which the money is supposed to go.
So, I mean, because you see the concern, I guess, for us is that does narrow the title to a somewhat smaller subcategory of housing-related programs, right? And if Mr. Dunn is able to convince the Supreme Court that there's a bunch of money that this tax would bring in that would go to other housing programs that aren't really affordable housing programs, that then the whole thing gets thrown out and you guys have to start over. That's my concern. But if you aren't concerned about that, then I'm willing to insert affordable, I think.
And I think that's consistent with the operation of Section 3.2. After the administrative costs are paid, the money shall be used for grants and loans to support statewide creation and preservation of affordable housing stock through these various programs. If those programs, the 2A through J in Section 3, don't go to support the creation and preservation of affordable housing stock, they don't get the money. I mean, I think Mr. Dunn in his motion for rehearing talked about large biofuel projects or something of that nature. If energy efficient improvements such as biofuels, solar, whatever, don't go to the creation and preservation of affordable housing stock, then it is not something within the purview of the program.
Well, and one other thing I want to bring up is I personally prefer erring on the side of breadth in line three, kind of the way we have it. But related to this discussion is line six and seven, because there's where we're talking about the permissible uses for affordable housing purposes. Now, I think there I'm more comfortable talking about affordable housing and purposes, and maybe expanding that and talking a little bit more about that. I'm just maybe a little more cautious about narrowing the single subject to affordable housing-related purposes. And perhaps I'm just not following the discussion, but it seems to me even these things, again, foreclosure and homeless prevention services and so forth, it's just not, I'm just not quite there that this is necessarily limited to what I understand affordable housing, what that phrase to mean.
Like I said, those programs are only part of this if they go specifically to preserving or creating affordable housing stock.
Well, it says that, but I'm just having trouble understanding that that's the way this measure would be interpreted. Maybe I'm just not understanding the arguments well enough, but I mean, I know the introductory portion. It says, you know, creation, preservation, affordable housing stock through these things, but I'm just still not there understanding why foreclosure prevention or homeless prevention, in fact, creates or preserves affordable housing stock.
Well, for someone who's facing foreclosure, it preserves their affordable housing unit. It keeps them in their house.
But not because the housing is affordable. And that, I'm going back to what I think a common understanding of the term affordable housing means. I mean, I live near Stapleton. They talk about affordable housing. And I think they're talking about the cost of housing, as I said earlier. I think, and maybe I'm just wrong, but that's when I hear the phrase affordable housing, that's what I think of, regardless of income. Now, there may be income limits for particular programs, but I'm saying to me it signals that this is not million-dollar homes.
Which I think is accurate. I think the way this provision works with the low-income, very low-income workforce household, those are the lower income. So affordable housing in that sense is accurate because it ties into their limited means. For the very low income, the homelessness.
Well, again, maybe it is circular, maybe it is just because I'm not understanding that affordable housing is signals necessarily housing for homeless people. To me, it signals housing for working people who can afford the housing.
And there are a lot of homeless people who actually are working people. I think the danger here with leaving it without having the modifier is you talk about the creation of a real estate transfer tax to fund housing-related programs. Housing-related programs, as far as I know, that could be, you know, rebates to contractors, development breaks, all sort of things that could be seen as something that development business, a lot of my clients would benefit from. I think the phrase affordable housing is a proper, number one, it's used in the measure, and it is accurately described the type of programs. I think housing-related programs is too general to encompass the subject of the measure.
Okay. And I may end up supporting that. Again, I'm just concerned that it's not a clear expression of the single subject, that it reinserts the potential that there may be a catchphrase argument and that it might be misleading. But I know you feel pretty strongly that you can defend it, so, like Mr. Domenico says, that I think that is something to influence us if you understand that that's a risk. I'm not sure if we had a motion on this, Mr. Domenico.
Yeah,
you might want to modify it.
You had a motion, actually.
I'll withdraw my motion if you want to modify what the.
Okay, if your motion is withdrawn, I would add on line 3 between fund and housing the word affordable. Given that I do think it's somewhat riskier to the proponents, both in narrowing the single subject, in which case there could be a problem if the measure is actually broader than that, and it does reintroduce the catchphrase argument, which, as I said before, I don't quite view affordable housing as a catchphrase.
I just have a quick suggestion. I don't know that we need the
yeah.
I don't think that adds anything.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. The related part, to the extent it adds anything, it may broaden it a little bit. And again, if you're willing to keep it as narrow as possible, I'm not quite sure I agree with Mr. Hobbs that, as I've said a number of times in the past, I think there are dozens of ways we can write a title that are all discharge our duty and accurate, and a lot of that depends on raising and lowering the level of generality we write it in. I'm not sure I agree that I would err on trying to adopt the broadest one of all the options. I would generally try to err on adopting the narrowest one that's accurate and doesn't leave things out. And so related, I'm willing to get rid of related for the same reasons. I do think it narrows it a little bit to get rid of it if it does anything. And so that's what I would suggest that we use.
I'll second that for discussion. Mr. Dunn?
On that point, I think it's actually important to include, because if you take it out, I think, as you said, the common understanding of affordable housing is housing. And as we've discussed, this measure has a much broader application than that. And I think when you say affordable housing-related programs, it says, okay, there's housing and things related to that this measure applies to. I think that's important that people understand that in the single subject clause, that it encompasses provisions related, arguably, to affordable housing, but it's not just limited to physical structures of housing.
Okay. Thank you. Discussion by the board on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Further changes to the title? Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of giving more information to the voters about the types of programs, I've been scribbling. I don't know if it's of any help, but perhaps instead of the phrase that currently starts on line 6 about specifying the permissible uses and allocations of money in the fund for affordable housing purposes, maybe we remove that phrase and in its place put something like requiring monies in the fund to be used for programs relating to, and then similar to what we've done on the severance tax measures, actually list out, adds length to the title, but whether or not it's important enough to actually list the purposes for which the money is being spent, that would be consistent with what we've done on similar measures, spending a revenue source for a variety of purposes. And so whether or not then we have to go into construction, real property acquisition, or at least property acquisition, pre-development, ordinance compliance costs, building rehabilitation, assistance with purchase costs, energy efficiency improvements, accessibility modifications, and construction and foreclosure and homelessness prevention, whether or not we'd want to do that. And I don't know whether we'd want to, because of the laundry list, put it at the end, but it seems to fit where that phrase was on line 6, but it adds a lot of words right there. But I think it relates more to where you talked about the creation of the fund rather than sticking it at the end where you have some of the general provisions described at the end of the title.
Yeah, and I think something along these lines would be helpful to me, because I think it helps offset what I'm still concerned about what we've done in line 3, but I think it then pushes me towards more words to flesh out a little better what the measure deals with. But Mr. Dunn?
I don't have a specific suggestion, but I think you can group sort of the construction ideas probably together, some of those things that are listed in 2. But I think it's important to separately enumerate things that are beyond construction ideas or pre-development ideas. In terms of homelessness, in terms of the social programs that are associated with the housing. Make sure that voters understand that those are the types of services, such as drug treatment, alcohol treatment, health care, those kind of things are enumerated.
I think we should just list them. It'll be too hard to try to come up with our own way to group a few of them and list a few of them, I think.
Okay.
I'm okay with that as long as the other type of things are included as well.
Yeah.
I think we'd strike that phrase. Substitute. Requiring monies in the fund. To be used for housing programs relating to construction, comma, real property acquisition, comma, redevelopment, comma, ordinance compliance costs, comma, building rehabilitation, comma, assistance with purchase costs. I'm open once we get it to tweak it any way we want. Energy efficiency improvements, comma, accessibility modifications and construction, comma, and foreclosure and homelessness prevention.
Only thing that I'm not sure is an important material in the sense of something that we need to tell voters about that this doesn't tell them is that it's sort of done through grants and loans to nonprofits and or local housing authorities, and I just wonder, I don't know if we need to put that in there or not, but
I think we could easily put in, you know, the reference to grants and loans. I don't know that I feel in terms of the types of entities that they go through, but if you want to say to be used for grants and loans for housing programs, we could insert that up on line 7.
I actually think that is less important than the who it's going to, and so if we're not going to put who it's going to, I'd rather just leave it, I think.
And we didn't make any of those references in the phrase that we had early in the previous draft.
Right. I think I'm okay with it as is. I can't think of a reason why we should have to include that, but I could be missing something. I guess someone could sort of be concerned that this is sort of going to be funding a bunch of groups that the state doesn't really have control over, or local government, that it's non-governmental organizations. But I don't know that it's material enough for us to include it in the title. It's probably not. I just wanted to bring it up.
Well, I'm okay with the language as is.
The only, yeah, if we're moving on kind of from this, the only, because I'm okay with that too, I agree with that. Ms. Eubanks is certainly correct that Representative Bruce's suggestion is not quite accurate, but I do think it's worth considering whether the idea that we should signal to people, not that they're repealing part of Tabor, because they're not, but they're creating an exception or changing the current constitutional, that this isn't just something new, that it also is something that's explicitly prohibited in the Constitution. I'm not convinced that Tabor is a catchphrase at all, and so it wouldn't bother me to put it in there. But I'm also not convinced that we need to put any reference like that in. I just wanted to bring it up that even though it's not a repeal of Tabor, it is creating an exception to it, or it's authorizing something that's currently prohibited, and I just wonder if that's, I can understand why Representative Bruce thinks that that's a material point that we ought to tell voters about, but I also sort of see it as kind of an effect that's not really our usual course of business. So I think I'm okay as is. I just wanted to bring it up.
Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the language that we're dealing with on lines 7 through 10, on line 8, the word cost, I believe, should be plural, costs. I'd move that language.
Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And I don't see the need to insert the language about Tabor. I guess I do wonder why we have the clause at the end. I think we discussed this, so maybe somebody can remind me, but why do we say requiring the General Assembly to enact legislation? That's, now that we've lengthened the title, I'm not sure why we need that clause.
I agree with you.
And I'll move that we strike the last clause and insert an and before the preceding clause, before the word exempting. I'll move that change.
Okay.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
One point that Ms. Eubanks briefly mentioned that highlights is whether we want to move the laundry list to the end and move that to before the laundry list. I don't know that I have a strong feeling either way.
Ms. Eubanks?
It just seems that it seems to flow. I mean, you talk about imposition of the real estate transfer tax, the creation of the fund, then you're talking about the purpose for which the fund, about the exemption of the tax. I mean,
yeah, I think I'm fine.
Know, it's half dozen.
Right.
Guess I'll move that we put the title in all caps.
Oh, I'll second that.
Any discussion? And again, I'm making that motion premised on the fact that the Secretary of State, although I don't see it happening in this case, might later make a different judgment when certifying the measure to the ballot if it gathers enough signatures. Did you use small caps on that, Ms. Gomez? Yes.
Mr. Hobbs?
Mr. Dunn.
Before you guys go to the final step, I guess, I didn't know if you guys, number one, finished the discussion on the grants and loans. Was there a consensus on that? Felt it important to include that the state would be engaging in lending business. I don't know. I know it was mentioned, but I don't know if it was ever. And then also some of the other, at least one other about the reference to the $40 for each, or 44 cents per $100.
You know, I didn't comment on that. I guess, to me, it's a relatively minor point on the $40, et cetera. But I felt like actually it wasn't quite accurate to say it that way, because I don't know whether that then implies $40 for each whole $100,000. That could, if it's a $550,000 piece of property and it's $40 per $100,000, is that $40 times 5 or $40 times 5.5? And it's less of an issue if we're faithful to the language of the measure. You know what I'm saying? I mean, to me, it's a minor point. That was my personal concern about your suggestion.
Right. I guess the difference is sort of that issue weighed against the concern that voters are trying to figure out exactly what this is in real dollar terms.
Mm-hmm.
That's the concern I was trying to address. That people can read that and easily say, okay, how does this affect me if I go to sell my house?
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Hobbs. I think it's better if they're concerned, they can do the math. I do think, though, that putting it in caps has highlighted the change we made last time of writing out 4 cents. I would go back, I think, to, if we're going to be using symbols and numerals, to use it all around. And one thing, I think Mr. Hobbs expressed the concern that as it was written, where it was just there was, I think, a dollar sign, a decimal, and a zero and a four, the decimal, I think, can get lost when you write it that way, and so you might just write it dollar sign 0.04, but solves that problem. I would suggest that's a little bit easier to read, but I'm happy with it as is. As for the lending issue, I think the consensus was that was not something we thought needed to go in there, because it's not, I don't think it's quite, they're not really going into the lending business as in the mortgage business. It's that the programs, the way the fund is administered, is that the state can loan or give money to nonprofit organizations. And, you know, I guess the risk of lending that you brought up is that you don't get paid back. But if the state could just give it all away in grants anyway, it's the possibility that they might get some of their money back is just gravy, right? The fact that some of it might be loans rather than just straight grant of money is only a benefit to the state or to taxpayers, at least. So I don't think it's quite accurate that we need to tell people that the state's going to start engaging in the mortgage business. And so the question for me is whether it's material that the state's going to be providing money, whether through grants or loans, to non-governmental organizations. And I think the consensus is that it's not the sort of thing that needs to be in the title.
Ms. Eubanks?
I agree with Mr. Domenico, but also Mr. Kneiser pointed out, and I think based on some of the comments of what the Housing Division currently does, that they do grants and loans right now. So in terms of them doing it into this revenue source for these purposes, it's really not new.
Yeah, and there is a danger that just saying that the state will be providing grants and loans could misleadingly imply that it will be sort of really would be going into the direct lending to people trying to buy houses business, which I don't think is accurate.
And I on the 4 cents issue, I prefer the words, but Mr. Domenico, I agree. Actually, part of my problem last time was the way the staff draft had the dollar sign .04. If we were to go back to numerals, a dollar sign 0.04, I think, is better. I'm still concerned that that's hard for some people to read or to understand. So personally, I prefer to leave the words. But
well, there's the very lawyerly option of doing both, like you see in a lot of contracts with 4 cents, which I've always found just really obnoxious and pedantic. So maybe we should avoid that and just leave it. I'm happy either way, I think.
Any further? Let's see, I guess I think I moved the all capitals. Was there a second? I think.
Yeah, I seconded that.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any further changes to the title? If not, I guess I'll move that the motions for rehearing be denied, except to the extent that the board has amended the title with the understanding that the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause.
Second.
Any further discussion? That's been moved and seconded. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 103. The time is 4:15 p.m. I think I'd like to take about a 5-minute break. That's okay.
This one?